From New York, this is Democracy Now! The president is not above the law. The Supreme Court has rejected Trump's claim of absolute immunity under law. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston. Then, on the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. That's the opening line of the Supreme Court decision that delivers a major victory for indigenous sovereignty by ruling half of Oklahoma remains Native American land. It was written by Trump appointee Justice Neil Gorsuch. We'll get response from attorney Sarah Deer, a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma, author of The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. But first, after months of downplaying the severity of COVID-19, Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, a Trump ally, tests positive.
Estou tomando aqui a terceira dose da...
Here I'm taking the third doses of hydroxychloroquine. I feel very well.
Bolsonaro took off his mask when he announced the news. Now several reporters are in quarantine and are suing the president. We'll go to Brazil, the world's second hardest hit country after the United States, to speak with leading Brazilian epidemiologist Cesar Victora. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a pair of 7-2 rulings, the Supreme Court has rejected President Trump's claim of absolute immunity under law. The court ruled a Manhattan grand jury could have access to the president's tax returns, but it remains unlikely any of Trump's tax records will be seen before the election. In both cases, Chief Justice John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch sided with the liberal justices. Roberts wrote, quote, "In our system, the public has a right to every man's evidence, and since the founding of the republic, every man has included the president of the United States," they wrote. In a separate decision, the court affirmed that Congress can subpoena records from a president, but ordered a lower court to reconsider the significant separation of powers concerns before such subpoenas are approved. Trump lashed out at the court's rulings.
So from a certain point, satisfied. From another point, I'm not satisfied because, frankly, this is a political witch hunt, the likes of which nobody's ever seen before. It's a pure witch hunt. It's a hoax.
In a major victory for indigenous sovereignty, the Supreme Court ruled Thursday about half of Oklahoma remains Native American land, recognizing a 19th-century U.S. treaty with the Muscogee Creek Nation. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. The Muscogee Creek Nation welcomed the ruling, issuing a statement saying, quote, "The Supreme Court today kept the United States' sacred promise to the Muscogee Nation of a protected reservation. Today's decision will allow the nation to honor our ancestors by maintaining our established sovereignty and territorial boundaries." We'll have more on the Supreme Court's decisions later in the program. The United States recorded over 65,000 new coronavirus cases Thursday, the highest daily figure since the pandemic began. At least six states set single-day case records: Alabama, Idaho, Missouri, Montana, Oregon, and Texas. Hospitalizations are surging across much of the country. In Florida, intensive care units are reported to be at capacity in over 40 hospitals. In Mississippi, the state's five largest hospitals have all run out of ICU beds. In Corpus Christi, Texas, officials have asked FEMA for a portable morgue due to a surge in COVID-19 deaths. And new outbreaks are being reported across the country. In Missouri, a popular summer camp was shut down after 82 campers and staff tested positive for the virus. In Kentucky, Governor Andy Beshear has ordered all residents to begin wearing masks in public, citing a, quote, explosion of cases. On Thursday, the top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said states with major outbreaks should seriously look at shutting down again. New statistics show COVID cases in Florida have increased more than tenfold since the state reopened in early May. In Arizona, cases have soared by over 800% after reopening. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to downplay the severity of the crisis by saying the spike in confirmed cases is because, quote, our testing is much bigger and better, unquote, than any other country's. On Thursday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel appeared to indirectly criticize Trump's handling of the pandemic. During a speech at the European Parliament, Merkel said, quote, the limits of populism and denial of basic truth are being laid bare. In other international news, India, South Africa, and Mexico all reported setting new daily infection records Thursday. India is approaching 800,000 confirmed cases, the world's third highest total behind the United States and Brazil. In Latin America, several top Bolivian officials have tested positive, including the interim president, Jeanine Añez, and Bolivia's health minister. In Venezuela, the second most powerful figure in the country, Socialist Party leader Diosdado Cabello, has tested positive. Meanwhile, in Syria, a doctor in Idlib has contracted the virus, raising fears the pandemic could spread to refugee camps in northwest Syria. In economic news, another 1.3 million people have filed for unemployment aid, bringing the total to 48 million over the past 16 weeks. This comes as Republican lawmakers are refusing to extend a program that's given unemployed workers an extra $600 in weekly jobless benefits. The program ends later this month, and housing advocates fear it could lead to a surge in evictions. The COVID-19 Eviction Defense Project has estimated 20 million renters are at risk of eviction by the end of September. In a major campaign speech, Democratic presidential candidate, former Vice President Joe Biden, laid out a $700 billion economic recovery plan focused on increasing federal spending on U.S.-made products and technology. He dubbed the plan Buy American. The proposal has been compared to Senator Elizabeth Warren's campaign call to invest $1.5 trillion in federal spending on U.S.-made clean energy products. Biden spoke in Pennsylvania.
Donald Trump may believe that pitting Americans against Americans will benefit him. I don't. We have a health crisis, an economic crisis, a racial justice crisis, a climate crisis. We need to come together to solve these crises, to solve them as Americans. This is our moment to imagine and to build a new American economy for our families and for our communities.
Meanwhile, a task force made up of allies of Joe Biden and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders have released policy recommendations that will be used to draft the Democratic Party's new platform. The task force endorsed free pre-K, tuition-free public college for most families, student loan forgiveness, carbon-free power by 2035, the end of private prisons, and the end of cash bail. The report did not endorse two key planks of Sanders' campaign, Medicare for All, and a Green New Deal. In Missouri, police have broken up a protest encampment on the steps of St. Louis City Hall. Protesters had been camping out since Wednesday, demanding the resignation of the St. Louis mayor, who's faced criticism for publicly reading out loud the names and addresses of protesters who called for the police to be defunded during a recent live video briefing. In Washington state, a veto-proof majority of the Seattle City Council has backed a proposal to slash the Seattle Police Department's budget by 50%. Seattle's mayor and police chief have opposed the move to defund the police. Utah has declared a state of emergency following a night of protests in Salt Lake City. On Thursday, the Salt Lake County District Attorney announced no officers would be charged in the killing of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, a 22-year-old man who was shot at more than 30 times as he fled police in May. On Thursday, protesters splashed red paint on the DA's office and splattered red paint on the street outside. The man's family now plans to sue the city. The Intercept's reporting a controversial artificial intelligence startup with ties to Twitter has been helping police agencies digitally monitor the recent Black Lives Matter protests. The company, Dataminer, which has received funding from the CIA, reportedly surveilled dozens of protests by tracking social media posts and then converting the information into police intelligence packages. Here in New York, the city has painted the words Black Lives Matter in large, bright yellow letters just outside Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue. Mayor Bill de Blasio took part in the painting. Anthony Beckford of Black Lives Matter Brooklyn supported the city's move.
When people look at this thing here, those who really are filled with hate, they become empowered by it. Now we're countering them, letting them understand that we will be at the doorstep of hate, and we will basically get rid of the ideology of white supremacy and racism.
Newly released data from the Small Business Association show at least 8 hate groups, including anti-immigrant and anti-LGBT organizations, have received loans under the Paycheck Protection Program. One recipient was the Center for Immigration Studies. The Southern Poverty Law Center has labeled the center a hate group in part because it circulated the writings of white nationalists and anti-Semitic writers on at least 2,000 occasions in recent years. The Center for Immigration Studies received up to $1 million under the PPP program. This comes as small Black and Latinx business owners say they were shut out of the loan program. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, broke with President Trump Thursday and signaled support for changing the names of U.S. military bases named after Confederate generals. Milley told the House Armed Services Committee there's no place in the armed forces for, quote, symbols of racism.
We've also got to take a hard look at the symbology, the symbols, things like Confederate flags and statues and bases and all that kind of stuff. The Confederacy, the American Civil War, was fought, and it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of treason at the time against the Union, against the Stars and Stripes, against the U.S. Constitution. And those officers turned their back on their oath.
At least 10 U.S. bases are named after Confederate generals, including Fort Benning, Fort Bragg, and Fort Hood. At the same hearing, General Milley said the Pentagon's not corroborated reports that Russia has paid bounties to the Taliban to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan, or that any U.S. service members have died due to the alleged Russia program.
Now, I want to get to specifically to the bounties. That is a unique, discrete piece of information that is not corroborated.
The mayor of Seoul, South Korea, has been found dead in an apparent suicide just days after a sexual harassment complaint was filed against him by a member of his staff. Mayor Park Won-sun was one of the most powerful politicians in South Korea, was considered a possible future presidential candidate. In immigration news, Immigration and Customs Enforcement reportedly plans to launch a 6-week so-called Citizens Academy class in Chicago, where the agency plans to teach attendants defensive tactics and firearms familiarization to arrest undocumented people. Immigrant rights advocates are sounding the alarm on the initiative, which ICE hopes to expand nationwide. Silky Shah, executive director of the Detention Watch Network, said, quote, ICE is recruiting an army of citizens to fuel its propaganda machine and forge hatred in our communities. The outcome of this program will be more terror unleashed upon immigrant communities and people of color. In more immigration news, BuzzFeed reports the Trump administration's told a federal judge immigrant families should not be released from the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, prompting fears that immigrant children could potentially be separated from their parents once again. The court filing comes over a week after a federal judge ordered ICE to free children in their custody by mid-July due to concerns over rising coronavirus infections. That ruling stems from a March lawsuit demanding ICE release all families held at 3 detention centers in Texas and Pennsylvania. Immigrant rights advocates fear the move by the Trump administration could force immigrant parents to choose between separating from their children or exposing them to COVID-19. And the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department has ruled that suicide was the cause of death for a 24-year-old Black man found hanging from a tree in the city of Palmdale, California. Robert Fuller's body was found June 10th. The FBI had launched a probe into Fuller's death after his family questioned the initial ruling that he had killed himself. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Brazil, where coronavirus cases are soaring. More than 1.7 million people have tested positive. Nearly 70,000 have died. Brazil is the second hardest hit nation in the world after the United States. On Tuesday, the far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, announced he tested positive for COVID-19 after months of downplaying the severity of the pandemic. He recently developed a high fever and a cough and said he's taking hydroxychloroquine, even though it's been proven ineffective against COVID-19, in some cases deadly.
Here I'm taking the third doses of hydroxychloroquine. I feel very well. There are other things that can help battle coronavirus, and we know none has been scientifically proven, but it's working for me.
As President Bolsonaro announced he had tested positive, he took off his mask. Some of the reporters who were present have now been put in quarantine, and the Brazilian Press Association has filed a criminal complaint to the Brazilian Supreme Court. They allege Bolsonaro committed at least two crimes by putting someone's life or health at imminent risk and failing to prevent the spread of an infectious disease. All of this comes as Brazil has gone 55 days with no health minister. The last two were fired or resigned within 30 days of each other for endorsing science. The grandmother of Brazil's first lady, Michelle Bolsonaro, is also suffering from COVID-19. She was recently transferred to an ICU unit and is reportedly intubated. For more, we go to Brazil, where we're joined by Cesar Victora, a Brazilian epidemiologist who led the first study to assess the prevalence of coronavirus in Brazil. He coordinates the International Center for Equity and Health at the Federal University of Pelotas in Brazil, where he's emeritus professor of epidemiology. He also has honorary appointments at Oxford, Harvard, and Johns Hopkins universities. Professor Victora, thanks so much for joining us. Can you talk about your president testing positive as he has downplayed the pandemic, calling it a little flu, taking off his mask at his press briefing, exposing journalists, and then the bigger story of what's happening in Brazil, directly connected, I believe, to his attitude?
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here today. The bad political leadership is a major risk factor for the spread of the pandemic, not only in Brazil, but also in your own country. Bolsonaro has repeatedly denied the importance of the pandemic. He's, as you just mentioned, he dismissed two health ministers who were against the use of hydroxychloroquine and were in favor of social distancing. He has repeatedly joined crowds in front of his presidential palace, usually on Sunday mornings, where he hugs people and people take selfies with him. And he has he's been very few times he has worn a mask. Even now, as he gave the news that he was infected, then he took a couple steps back and he removed his mask in front of a whole team of journalists who the Press Association is now suing him. So the bad leadership means that the federal government is saying this is not, this is a small flu, as Bolsonaro said early on, and that nobody will, it will only affect a few people. It's not severe. And that means that social distancing is not important. He's been in sharp contrast with many state governors and city mayors who have been acting in a much more responsible way. So, but the contradictory advice that the population is getting from a president who says this is not a big problem and you should not worry about it, let's reopen the economy right away, and the good advice provided by medical associations, by scientists, by many state governors and city mayors. So it's a very complicated situation.
I wanted to ask about his approach to those in the rainforest area, indigenous people throughout Brazil, as he vetoed legislation to help them. Also talked about the possibility of sending the military in to bring them hydroxychloroquine. Of course, this is a drug that President Trump touted that turns out in a number of studies not only to be ineffective, but could possibly be deadly with coronary implications.
No, absolutely. You know, let me tell you what's happening to the rainforest now, because everybody's concerned about the pandemic. And so deforestation is now at a record pace, because the first thing that Bolsonaro did well before the pandemic, he and his minister of environment, was a very controversial person. They have relaxed all the system that took account of deforestation, including the satellite photos and so on. And he fired one of the top Brazilian scientists who was in charge of that surveillance system, which would show record levels of deforestation. At the same time, he's always, you know, since he's been for 28 years a member of parliament in the House in Brazil. And he was always saying indigenous people should not be protected. They have to be brought into civilization. He would reduce the size of indigenous reservations and so on. And he's actually, you know, you can't blame him for doing what he said he would do. You know, those people who voted for him knew who he was. It was amazing that he actually got about 55% of the vote in Brazil. Many of those people have repented and now regretting having ever voted for him. But I just wanted to give you a little bit of data on the indigenous population. We have completed now three rounds of surveys, each one in the largest 133 cities throughout the country. 33,000 is our sample size in each round. The most hardly affected group are indigenous people. They're five times as likely to have antibodies against COVID, which means that they have been exposed to the virus, than whites. So it's a fivefold difference between indigenous population and whites. And the government is playing down these numbers, completely trying to avoid disseminating these results, because they think it will look bad for Brazil, which obviously it does, and also because they don't really care about the indigenous population.
We interviewed Sebastião Salgado, world-famous Brazilian photojournalist who charges Bolsonaro with genocide against the indigenous people, with how he is dealing with the virus, particularly in relation to the indigenous population.
Absolutely. And this issue of distributing chloroquine to the indigenous population through the army, it's completely nonsense. It's completely, you know, he has completely ignored the scientific community in Brazil, the medical associations, the specialist groups, and he actually is, you know, what may well happen, he is taking hydroxychloroquine for his COVID. We know that, that COVID has a case fatality rate, which is pretty low. So most people survive. So the next step, if he survives, which is very likely to do, is that he will take credit for it and say, that's because I took hydroxychloroquine. I mean, he doesn't respect clinical trials. His argument is that since there's nothing else to do, why not take chloroquine? But as you just said, Amy, it has very serious cardiovascular side effects that could actually kill the person more rather than being killed by COVID.
Dr. Cesar Victor, you led the first study that assessed the prevalence of coronavirus in Brazil. And you said, in fact, there are several epidemics. Explain.
Exactly. You know, very unexpectedly, the first wave of the epidemic came through the Amazon River, which was not where we expected. We thought it would be arriving in Rio and São Paulo and the touristy cities in the Northeast, where lots of Italians, for example, come and for holidays. And actually, our hypothesis right now is that there are several Chinese industries in the city of Manaus, which is the largest city in the Amazon. And Manaus is a tax-free industrial hub where foreign companies can put on their own factories and sell to Brazil without paying importation tax. So there's a so strong exchange between Manaus, which is the first city in the Amazon where COVID was detected as early as February. And from Manaus, people travel in boats to the rest of the Amazon region. These boats are always overcrowded, and the boat trips take several hours, and even some for some cities, it takes 2 or 3 days by boat. So being in a crowded boat with someone who has COVID may well explain why the Amazon was hit so hard. Now, the epidemic in the Amazon is already going down. In some cities, we tested 25% of the population had antibodies, which is very, very high level. Now it's going down in the northeast and moving in the north and moving to the northeast, which is also a very poor area. The north and northeast are the two poorest areas in the country. We here in the south where I live are relatively low prevalence, but it's also increasing rapidly in the last couple of weeks. So it's several epidemics. And the striking thing is it did start with the white, educated, rich people who traveled abroad and who came from Italy, for example, or Spain. But now it's disseminating through the population. And the poor Brazilian, the poorest 20% of the population is twice more likely to have antibodies than the richest 20%. The blacks are more likely to have antibodies than whites. Indigenous are particularly high risk, too.
So let's talk about why this is, Dr. Victor. The extreme inequality in Brazil, both class and racial. Brazil's six richest men in the country hold the same amount of wealth as the poorest half of the population. Explain why there are these disparities.
Well, this is part of our historical pattern of colonization, which is the Portuguese, when they colonized Brazil, they usually came in, they gave large pieces of land, and I mean, you know, seriously, millions of acres to people, to Portuguese people to settle. Most of the settlement of Brazil was done by people who, unlike the United States, they were not moving to a new country to make that their homeland. They were not escaping from conditions of poverty or religious persecution in Europe. They were just people who came here to make money and go back. So the land structure in Brazil is very unfair. And it led to this issue that we now have a small proportion of rich people, and not only farmers, it's industry and everything, but it led to this hugely segregated society. Also, Brazil had the largest number of African slaves brought relative to any other country in America, in the Americas. So there's the black population, the Brazilian African Brazilians have always been kept in very poor conditions of living and so on. And what explains their higher rate of COVID antibodies is that they usually live in favelas or in cramped situations, lots of people in the same home. Very hard to practice social isolation. They live on they earn the money to buy their food on a daily basis doing informal work, which means that they have to go out, otherwise they won't have food to eat. And so it's a combination of several conditions. One more thing is that they often do not have proper water and sanitation facilities, and therefore things like washing hands is not trivial because they have to bring water from other places.
And you have Bolsonaro, who said when talking about masks, he said he taunted staffers wearing face masks to protest against COVID by claiming they were, quote, for fairies. Here you have what many call the tropical Trump, very close to President Trump, actually visited with Trump in Mar-a-Lago, and already there were infections of his press secretary and questions of this.
Yes.
President Trump and his team had been infected. Can you talk about President Trump's effect and his same approach as your president, Bolsonaro, in basically downplaying this pandemic? President Trump saying 99% of the COVID-19 cases are harmless.
Yes, well, Trump appears to be Bolsonaro's idol. Whatever Trump does, such as leaving the WHO, which is it's unbelievable. I've worked with WHO for 40 years in many places of the world, and I still can't believe that Trump has actually pulled out of the WHO. But Bolsonaro is now saying he's going to do the same thing. So Trump is in favor of hydroxychloroquine. Bolsonaro is in favor. Now, FDA doesn't allow hydroxychloroquine in the U.S., and Trump is giving huge stocks of hydroxychloroquine to Brazil, and Bolsonaro says he's very happy to receive those. So, you know, it's a really bad combination of leaders in the two largest countries in this region of the world.
And number one and number two, President Trump proudly often talking about the United States as being number one, but number one and number two in COVID infections. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Cesar Victora, Brazilian epidemiologist who led the first study to assess the prevalence of coronavirus in Brazil, coordinates the International Center for Equity and Health at the Federal University of Pelotas in Brazil, where he's emeritus professor of epidemiology. Next, the president is not above the law. So says the Supreme Court, including President Trump's two appointees. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston. Stay with us. Elise Regina. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a pair of 7-2 rulings, the Supreme Court has rejected President Trump's claim of absolute immunity under the law. The court ruled a Manhattan grand jury can have access to the president's tax returns, but it remains unlikely any of Trump's tax returns will be seen before the election. In both cases, Chief Justice John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch sided with the liberal justices. Roberts wrote, quote, "In our system, the public has a right to every man's evidence. And since the founding of the republic, every man has included the president of the United States." Chief Justice Roberts cited historic rulings requiring President Richard Nixon to release tapes from his Oval Office conversations and President Bill Clinton to provide evidence in a sexual harassment lawsuit. He also relied on an 1807 trial in which Aaron Burr subpoenaed Thomas Jefferson, a move Chief Justice John Marshall deemed legal at the time. Roberts wrote, quote, 200 years ago, a great jurist of our court established that no citizen, not even the president, is categorically above the common duty to produce evidence when called upon in a criminal proceeding. We reaffirm that principle today and hold that the president is neither absolutely immune from state criminal subpoenas seeking his private papers, nor entitled to a heightened standard of need. In a separate decision, the court affirmed that Congress can subpoena records from a president, but ordered a lower court to reconsider the significant separation of powers concerns before such subpoenas are approved. Donald Trump lashed out at the rulings.
Well, the rulings were basically starting all over again, sending everything back down to the lower courts, and you start all over again. And so from a certain point, satisfied. From another point, I'm not satisfied, because, frankly, this is a political witch hunt, the likes of which nobody's ever seen before. It's a pure witch hunt. It's a hoax, just like the Mueller investigation was a hoax that I won. And this is another hoax. This is purely political. I win at the federal level, and we won very decisively, and so they send it into New York. And you know what's going on in New York. Everyone's leaving. It's turned out to be a hellhole.
Now to Rochester, New York, where we're joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, previously with The New York Times, now founder and editor of DCReport.org, has reported on Donald Trump for 30 years. His recent piece headlined, "The Supreme Court Hands Trump an Election Boost." He's written two books on President Trump, your former newspaper, The New York Times. David, it's headline, six-column banner headline, "President is not above the law, justices decide." And President Trump calls this whole thing a hoax. Your response?
Well, it is not the least bit surprising that all nine justices, including the two dissenters, agree that the president of the United States is not above the law and must comply with lawful subpoenas. What's troubling about the decision is that the court didn't say, and the subpoena may be enforced forthwith. Instead, they sent it back to the U.S. District Court in Manhattan, where there'll be further wrangling over this. Now, Donald Trump chose to take his complaints about the Manhattan grand jury subpoena to federal court, removed it from the state courts in so doing. The Supreme Court, therefore, could have said, you know, you chose your forum to seek your remedies. You've lost. And the subpoena is proper. By taking this back to a lower court, it has encouraged further litigation, which may be very brief or may go on for months. And that benefits Trump politically. So legally, Trump had a big loss. Legally had a big loss. Politically, he got a win out of this court. And this decision, I think, also reinforces a very disturbing trend in the Roberts Court, which seems to be that if you're wealthy and can afford more due process, the court will encourage you to get all the due process you want. That sends a signal to prosecutors and regulators not to mess with people who are going to fight back, because they will tie up your limited resources. So just look the other way or don't pick up cases like this.
So in terms of the election, this was a big political win for Donald Trump, though he didn't exactly take it that way, though his attorney, of course, who argued before the Supreme Court, took it as a big win. But talk about the difference between the congressional case and the New York case, because in the New York case, you're talking about a criminal prosecution. What could happen even after Trump steps down, if he agrees to, as president of the United States?
Well, Donald Trump can, and I suspect likely will, pardon himself, assuming he is voted out of office. And that's no certainty at all. But that only covers federal crimes. The New York case is a state case brought by the district attorney in Manhattan, and presidential pardons do not apply. The Manhattan district attorney already has the information on Donald Trump's federal tax returns because the IRS and all the states share information with one another. What they don't have and what they're seeking with a subpoena are the business records and accounting records, because if those don't line up, if Donald Trump's tax returns deviate from the business and accounting records, then that's fraud. Now, the other case, which was also 7-2, involved Congress's duty, powers, and rights of oversight. Congress, after all, makes the laws, and the president, the executive, basically is assigned to do and fulfill the obligations and responsibilities that Congress assigns to him. However, in this case, the three committees issued very, very broad subpoenas. I mean, they wanted stuff down to credit card records. And the court was skeptical of the scope of that claim, and perhaps rightly so. I think that the proper groundwork wasn't laid there. On the other hand, Adam Schiff, one of the key members of the House, says they will now go back and lay the groundwork for this so that they can obtain the records they're seeking of the president. And keep in mind that Donald Trump has worked very hard to hide his business records, and we know why. I revealed 4 years ago that he had had two income tax fraud trials over his 1984 tax return. They were civil fraud, not criminal fraud. The New York Times, in work that they in print very nicely said was inspired by my work, wrote this remarkable, absolutely perfectly executed piece in October of 2018, in which they said flat out Donald Trump and his siblings are serial tax cheats. And we now know that the principal source of records that they used for this came from Mary Trump, Donald Trump's niece, who just published a book about him.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about Donald Trump's niece, Mary Trump, a clinical psychologist, and her new book, Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. Mary Trump's father was Fred Trump Jr. He was Donald Trump's older brother. Fred Jr. died of a heart attack in 1981 after a struggle with alcohol and addiction. Mary Trump wrote that after Donald Trump's inauguration, quote, "The smallest thing, seeing Donald's face or hearing my own name, both of which happened dozens of times a day, took me back to the time when my father had withered and died beneath the cruelty and contempt of my grandfather. I'd lost him when he was only 42 and I was 16. The horror of Donald's cruelty was being magnified by the fact that his acts were now official U.S. policy affecting millions of people," she wrote. Donald Trump's younger brother, Robert, is seeking to block the sale of the book, saying it violates a confidentiality agreement. However, the publisher, Simon & Schuster, told a court Thursday that 600,000 copies of the book have already been distributed ahead of its July 14th publishing date. A court ruling is expected any day now. And though the book is out, Mary Trump has been enjoined from speaking. So talk about, since you've written two books on Donald Trump and written about some of what she writes about in this book, the significance of this book.
Well, we've broadly known that the house Donald Trump grew up in was a house of absolute horrors. His father was a monster. He's a very, very competent businessman, but he was corrupt. His business partner was a front for the Genovese and Gambino crime families. But what Mary brings to this book is an insider's knowledge combined with her PhD in clinical psychology. So she's able to tell anecdotes we have never heard before. There's lots of new information like that. She's able to connect the nature of this house and what went on. I mean, on the night that her father had his heart attack and was taken from the Trump father, Fred Trump and Mary Trump's mansion, to the hospital, the parents just sat in the living room and did nothing. And Donald and his sister Elizabeth went to the movies. What kind of people do that? This is not a house of love. This is a house of lucre, where the only thing that mattered and the only measurement was how much money did you bring in today? Who did you cheat today? It didn't matter if you lie, cheat, and steal, so long as you got the money. That made you a winner. And Donald Trump, recognizing that his older brother was not built to deal with that. He withered under his father. He tried to escape him. He was a pilot for TWA Airlines for a period of time. Saw opportunity, and he then shaped himself to be what his father wanted, to be the magnification of his father. And in fact, many of Donald Trump's stunts I've written about in the past, as have others, actually began with Fred Trump. He just was not as widely known outside of the outer boroughs of New York. I think this is a very, very important book. It's not terribly long. It's crisply written. And I encourage everybody to read this book. I think it will open people's eyes to how did this sociopath get to the White House.
And that's certainly what the psychologist, his niece, calls him, a sociopath. Finally, Mary Trump alleges that President Trump, Donald Trump, paid a friend to take his SATs.
Well, at the time that you and I would have taken our SATs, it was easy to hire someone to cheat for you. Today, they have photo IDs and proctors, and they check all these things. But, I mean, it was not unheard of during the 60s for rich boys to hire other, or maybe rich girls, to hire other people to take their tests. And, of course, we had colleges all over the place that were accepting students who were not qualified and helping them evade the draft, which meant that poor boys, often black and brown poor boys, went off to die in Vietnam. Well, you know, Donald Trump has famously said, you know, he was dodging venereal disease in Manhattan with all the women he was chasing, and that was his Vietnam.
W.K. Johnston, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and we'll continue to cover these stories. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, previously with the New York Times, now with DCReport.org. He has written two books on Donald Trump. When we come back, we look at another major Supreme Court decision, delivering a major victory for indigenous sovereignty in Oklahoma. Stay with us.
We're gonna keep on struggling, struggle every day. We're bound to choose life in this struggle. Don't try to run away.
No, no, no. Within us and without us, we've
got to fight the beast.
Well, my sisters and my brothers,
we shall be released.
Living in a world that's free,
we shall be released.
Be what we want to be,
we shall be released.
Yeah,
we shall be released.
Belly of the Monster by the Red Star Singers. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major victory for indigenous sovereignty, the Supreme Court ruled Thursday that about half of Oklahoma remains Native American land, recognizing a 19th century U.S. treaty with the Muscogee Creek Nation in a narrow 5-4 ruling. Justice Neil Gorsuch, who joined the court's liberal wing, wrote the majority opinion. It began, quote, "On the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. Forced to leave their ancestral lands in Georgia and Alabama, the Creek Nation received assurances that their new lands in the West would be secure forever. Because Congress has not said otherwise, we hold the government to its word," he wrote. The landmark decision is based on the case of Jim C. McGirt, a Native man who the state of Oklahoma convicted in 1997 for sex crimes against a 4-year-old child on Muscogee Creek land. McGirt argued that because the crime took place on the tribe's territory, the state had no jurisdiction to try his case, a claim the Supreme Court affirmed in its decision. Cherokee writer and advocate Rebecca Nagel tweeted, quote, "The big news at the Supreme Court today will be Trump's taxes, but for Indians in Oklahoma, Oklahoma will be talking about today for decades. After a century of Oklahoma not following our treaty rights, the Supreme Court said no more. Eastern Oklahoma is Indian country," she wrote. Well, for more on this historic ruling, we go to Lawrence, Kansas, where we're joined by Sarah Deer, citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation, lawyer, professor at the University of Kansas, author of The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sarah Deer. Can you talk about the significance of the Supreme Court ruling penned by none other than President Trump's appointee, Neil Gorsuch?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. You know, it's really interesting. The politics on the court don't necessarily, when it comes to Indian country, fall into a liberal conservative division. Indian law is kind of unique in that way. In fact, Justice Ginsburg, who, of course, is a woman attorney I have utmost respect for, has not always sided with tribal interests. But Gorsuch was an interesting selection because although his social justice issues on other matters are problematic, he actually has a pretty good track record in the Tenth Circuit of recognizing and acknowledging tribal rights. And so when he was nominated, in fact, the National Congress of American Indians supported his nomination because they saw in his writings in the lower courts that he really did understand tribal sovereignty and was willing to look at the history in order to resolve disputes.
So, again, this ruling says that half of Oklahoma is Native American land. What does this mean?
Well, I have to say that's not entirely accurate. It doesn't mean that the land is all under tribal control now. What this does is it reasserts the boundaries of the reservation. So we know to the extent to which the tribe would have certain kinds of criminal authority. But in fact, for most people who have private land, who own private businesses within the confines of the reservation, will not be affected by this decision. It primarily affects the ability of the tribal government to assert itself in partnership with the federal government, but it doesn't change the status of, say, privately owned land.
So let's talk about what Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others raised, the issue of the thousands of convictions that have taken place there, put people in jail. What does this mean now?
Well, I think there's a lot of overstatement of this potential problem of releasing, you know, thousands of criminals into the streets. There's been no indication that there's a trend going in that direction, even though there have been two victories in the 10th Circuit on behalf of Native people. We don't see a flood of Native people using these cases to try to get released. And in fact, what will happen in most of the serious cases, so the cases involving things like murder and rape and child sexual abuse, is those will not be, those convictions may be overturned in the sense that Oklahoma was the wrong government to be prosecuting them. But there's no doubt that the federal government will take some of those folks into custody and ensure that the community is safe.
And of course, Jim C. McGurk, the man who brought this case, who won, it doesn't mean he goes free. It means he has to be tried in a federal court now rather than a state court. Is that right?
Exactly. And in fact, he could be tried in tribal court as well, because the tribe also shares that jurisdiction. The tribe, though, has very limited power to, say, impose incarceration or fines. And so oftentimes with these very, very serious crimes, the federal government is the only one that can provide the kind of safety the community might be looking for.
The ruling was based on the Muscogee Creek Nation's historic claims, but could also affect four other tribes, the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, and Seminole tribes. I think Jim C. McGirt was Seminole. Can you talk about the wider implications of this?
Sure. Well, it's a landmark case and probably the most important Indian law case in the last half a century to come down from the court. It's that powerful. Certainly, the other four tribes that were on the Trail of Tears, the Cherokees, as you mentioned, and the like, they have very similar treaties that the Creek Nation has. And so while there might be some nuance and difference in terms of exactly how the treaty plays out for these other tribes, essentially the question about what these treaties mean has been answered by the court. And so it would be unlikely that the state would be able to litigate successfully against those tribes to try to sort of retain their control over those reservation boundaries. So, and beyond that, just the language of the decision itself goes far beyond Oklahoma, because they're reiterating, what Gorsuch is doing is reiterating some foundational principles of tribal sovereignty. And so his analysis will have implications for all kinds of Indian law cases yet to come.
So you have Neil Gorsuch referencing the Trail of Tears. Describe for us that history. What happened? What forced so many Native Americans into Oklahoma?
Well, there were just many, many wealthy people who wanted access to the land, a plantation land that was so valuable to white landowners in that time period. See, we were in what is now Alabama and Georgia, where the plantation economies were at their strongest, and Indians were in the way, and Indians didn't want to move. And so, despite the fact that the court in that time period said that the president didn't have the right to remove the tribes, Andrew Jackson did just that and defied the Supreme Court, marched all five tribes at bayonet point to what is now Oklahoma against our will. And when we got there, we were promised that we would have the land there forever.
And talk about how President Andrew Jackson fits into the story. President Trump saying it was his favorite president. And now, for example, the Jackson City Council in Mississippi voting to take down the statue to Andrew Jackson.
Yes, Andrew Jackson was a brutal man, and he particularly around my tribe, my tribal's history, the Creek Nation, you know, engaged in warfare, dehumanized us, called us names, had no interest in compassion to be, you know, exerted towards our people, and really just marched us to a death march west to Oklahoma. And many, many tribal members died along the way because the circumstances were so dire. So we associate the five tribes in Oklahoma that we've been talking about do not have any affinity or affection for Andrew Jackson. He has been the cause of much of our troubles over the last two centuries.
Sarah Deer, you're a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation. You're author of the book, The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. This case that the Supreme Court historic decision is based on, Jim C. McGirt was involved in sexually attacking a four-year-old child. You have looked at violence against women and girls for years. Put it in that context for us.
Sure. Well, it certainly seems odd for me to advocate on behalf of a sex offender, given my work. But in this case, I see a larger issue about safety for Native women and girls and Two-Spirit people who are victims of violence. Because what this is doing is, while, yes, this McGirt case conviction is overturned, what I would like to see happen going forward, now that we have this case, is that actually the tribe can pick up some of these cases, because now our territorial reach is larger. And so we can engage in crime control in a larger area of the reservation. And I believe that tribal sovereignty is going to be key to protecting people from violence, because, you know, the state has, you know, doesn't have a vested interest in necessarily in the safety of the reservation. The federal government is far away, you know, taking down Enron and large-scale drug trafficking rings. And I would like to see the tribal nations, who do have criminal jurisdiction, now that's expanded territorially, to really pick up these cases and try to resolve them in a way that's going to make the community safe, but not necessarily replicate the law and order model of the state and federal governments.
Sarah Deer, can you talk about how the media has covered this historic Supreme Court decision on the last day of the Supreme Court's term, coming down the same day, of course, as the ruling on President Trump's tax returns?
Sure. Well, I can say the wait has been grueling. We've been waiting for this decision for well over a year and a half. I think that the headlines that I'm seeing, even in more sympathetic media, sort of overstating the case, and I think creating a lot of fear and anxiety for people in Oklahoma. It doesn't give land back, per se, and there's nothing that the tribe will be able to do to move people off their privately owned land or run their privately owned businesses. Very little is going to change on the ground for non-Indians. And so when I see headlines like, you know, the tribe has been given back land, it overstates it quite a bit. While it's still an important case, it's not giving the tribe power over most people that live on the reservation who are non-Native.
And so, putting this in the context of all the protests in this country right now around racial injustice, around the whole Black Lives Matter movement, around people of color being so violated over the years, yet not recognized, changing the narrative. Can you talk about how you see this decision changing the narrative and fitting into this uprising around the country?
Sure. Well, I think that the way Gorsuch is a beautiful writer, and there's no doubt in my mind that he used logic and legal reasoning to reach his decision. But his writing conveys something a little bit more that we typically don't see from the court, and that is a sense of empathy and compassion. And again, I'm not suggesting that was the basis of his decision, but to offer that in the rhetoric of his prose is gives me great, great hope. And I do think that this is coming at a very interesting time. While this case actually precedes the rising up of the contemporary Black Lives Matter movement, I think it's part of that same the same effort to raise awareness about oppression. And I think that Native people owe a debt of gratitude to the leadership of Black Lives Matter, because in raising those issues of race and injustice, we've also been able to elevate the issues of Native racism and injustice. And people who are sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter movement are more amenable to the sympathies for Native people. So I think it's not a coincidence that this case comes out at that kind of time.
We have to leave it there. Sarah Deer, citizen of the Muskogee Creek Nation, we thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.